Welcome to the Lift Every Voice podcast, where we explore books by contemplative writers of color. I'm Christine Walters Paintner.
And I'm Claudia Love Meyer. We are joined each month by the author of our book club selection. Together, we explore how increasing our diversity of perspectives on contemplative practice can enrich our experience of the Christian mystical tradition.
We encourage you to join us by reading the book, listening to the conversations, and engaging with the reflection questions on our website at abbeyofthearts.com. Welcome, everybody, to the Lift Every Voice Book Club. I'm Christine Walters Paintner of Abbey of the Arts, and I'm joined by my wonderful conversation partner, Claudia Love Meyer. And this month, we have the great pleasure of welcoming Tracy Michelle Lewis-Jiggetts here with us today to talk about this beautiful book, Then They Came for Mine, Healing from the Trauma of Racial Violence. So Tracy explores the intersection of culture, identity, and faith and spirituality at the deepest levels. She's the host of a podcast called Heart Talk with Tracy Michelle and founder of Heart Space, a healing community created to serve those who've experienced trauma of any kind through storytelling and the arts. And as a writer, Tracy's published 20 books, including many collaborations with other high-profile authors. And then in 2022, she published her critically acclaimed book, Black Joy, Stories of Resistance, Resilience, and Restoration, which was nominated for a 2023 NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Literary Work Instructional. Fantastic. But we're delighted to welcome her to talk about her brand new book, her newest book, Then They Came for Mine. So welcome, Tracy. It's wonderful to have you here with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
Lovely. Well, why don't we just start with you maybe introducing the book itself and what prompted you to write it?
Sure. It's interesting. With this book, it was born from my grief. I lost a family member to racial violence in 2018. My elder cousin, Vicki Lee Jones, was shot and killed in a grocery store shooting, and it was racially motivated, and I was processing that grief and figuring out how to move through spaces with all the work that I was doing around writing for social justice and doing DEI work on the campus where I taught, trying to figure out what it meant in light of this event that came close to home, that hit my family. And so that was sort of the beginning of writing this book. But I was very much interested in how we, the collective we, heal. How do Black folks heal? How do white people heal? Because there is an element of that. How do we deal with complicity from a faith standpoint, faith-based organizations, churches? How do we reckon with complicity? And so all of those things were kind of floating through my head as I was personally navigating the grief of this loss.
Yeah, and you tell that story really powerfully. Maybe Claudia Love, do you want to kick us off with?
Yeah, your dedication to Vicki. I vowed that when you were taken from us, your death would not only not be in vain, but be a catalyst for repair and restoration. My prayer is that this book honors you and the glorious legacy of love and care you left behind. The vow. What did you envision this catalyst for repair and restoration would look like when you made it? And what does it look like to you now?
I think the initial thought I had was for hard conversations to be had in spaces where they have not been had. And so I think to honor her legacy. My cousin Vicky was a very kind woman, a very helpful woman. She probably would have, taken the person who murdered her in. she was just that kind of person. Didn't meet a person she didn't like, was very forgiving. And so in the spirit of that, wanted to figure out what grace, what healing, what reconciliation, what reckoning looked like. Because I felt like at the time, at least, that the only way forward is for Black folks to have the space to heal. And for white people, and particularly white people who call themselves or believe themselves to be Christian, to be willing to sit in the hard places and to hear the hard truths and to reckon with the evidence of what's in their bloodline. Because a lot of times when we talk about transgenerational trauma, we talk about it from the lens of what Black folks have had to carry over centuries and or generations as a result of trauma. And I wanted to flip that a little bit and have the hard conversations about what makes this notion of white supremacy even exist? What even makes this notion of superiority exist? What makes this even the complicity in the silence, even if it's not as far as white supremacy, what makes complicity and silence exist? The dehumanization exist. And so I think my initial thought was, how do we have these hard conversations? If I can honor her, because she was about talking, she was about, if you can hear my story, then you can understand. At least you might not be able to be in my shoes, but you at least maybe possibly have some empathy from where I'm coming from. So I think initially I thought that it would just be about awareness, having the hard conversations. Now, I think I am wrestling with the fact that I think there needs to be even more. I'm thinking about what's beyond the hard conversations. And so I have in the book, I talk a lot about what does an ally look like? What does an accomplice look like? What is like, someone like, what does an advocate look like? And I think there it's more than just the conversation. There's a step beyond. I think that it's the reckoning. That piece, what does those actions look like? What risk will people who don't have to, who are not marginalized, who are privileged, what risk are they willing to take? And to exploring it beyond just the conversation, just beyond the education, just beyond the learning, just beyond even the empathy. And so that's what I think I am now. It's like the initial vision was hard conversations, awareness. Now it is what is beyond that? Because that to me is how we get to healing.
Well, what do you think? Name something that you can think of that would be beyond the conversation. Like, for example, I was talking to, this is when everybody was all about the emergent church. Remember that phase?
I do. I
When we were all emergent.
do.
And I was talking to some people, and then this was a group of white people because there weren't very many black people in this particular movement. And they were like, yeah, we're gonna get together and we'll have some conversation about the homeless crisis. And I said, they don't need conversation. They need a place to live. It was just like something really concrete. They need a place to live. And my thought, just throwing one thing out there, so we need more people of color. And Tracy, you're specifically writing about your Aunt Vicky's legacy. We need more Black people in leadership in the churches. We need more Black people that can safely say what their experiences are. What would you say is beyond beyond the conversation? Just one thing that you think about.
Maybe this might be a bit revolutionary or radical in some circles. I think yes, and yes, more Black people in leadership, more safe spaces, brave spaces to be able to share experiences without feeling hostility or feeling, you know, disenfranchisement or whatever. But, or not but, and they're going to have to be more risk-taking on the parts of those who have the privilege and the leadership and the power now. And what I mean by that is what we're seeing a lot from accomplices and allies are willing to put bodies on the line, you know, and that's a hard thing. Like, what are you willing to, are you willing to risk your status, your body, your reputation, your, what are you willing to put on the line? Because that's what's moved the needle in the past. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, I mean, if you think about the civil rights movement, you think about any of the major movements, it was the willingness of the marginalized to vocalize what was happening, to share the stories, to say what was happening and why it was happening and how it was hurtful and how it was harming them. But it was also in conjunction with those who had the power for change or to get the powers to be that listen, putting their reputations, their risks, their bodies on the line. So like when I see a protest happening, I think it was in South Africa in 2020, there was a protest where there was a chain of white people in front of Black people who were chanting, and right, and they were willing to put their bodies on the line because they knew that it's less likely that the bullets will come if they're standing in front. That is what this book wrestles with. This book wrestles with the, you know, challenging people in of privilege, white folks in particular, white people of faith in particular. Like, what are you real? You know, it's easy to put a box on social media, a black box on social media. It's easy to put Black Lives Matter on your, you know, your restaurant window. That is low hanging fruit, and we'll take it. Great. Right. But what is the real shape shifting that's going to happen? What is the real change? The real change is risk.
Yes. Mm. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Tracy. You know, you talk about how your own trauma related health challenges and how your body kind of fell apart with illness in 2019, and you were forced to be still for 8 months and you had to take leave from your teaching. I wonder if you could talk more about that time of challenge, and particularly when you talk about how you had to confront how you always valued yourself for what you did as opposed to who you are, and what possibilities did that open up for you, that time of Sabbath and rest?
Yeah, it was a time, I can say this in hindsight, it didn't feel like this in the moment, mm-hmm. but in hindsight, I see it was a time of liberation. It was a time of freedom. It didn't feel like that, as I said, in the moment. In 2019, late 2018, I lost my cousin. 2019, the spring of 2019, I was active in some really challenging diversity and inclusion work on campus, where we were getting a lot of pushback, a lot of hostile, a lot. And so it was taking its toll on me, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. And so in the summer of 2019, my body just stopped working. It's the only way that I can explain it. I went to all the doctors, did all the things, had all the tests. And I had a moment with an acupuncturist where she put a needle in a particular point in my body. And I was just going for like pain reduction, that kind of thing. And I wailed at the point that she stuck me. I wailed, I cried. She was a Christian. And so she prayed with me and she said, this is common. Like, there's trauma trapped in your body. That really got me into stillness, right? Like having to sit in contemplation. That's when I began to read more Father Keating and a lot of contemplatives, Barbara Holmes and Howard Thurman, and really began to embrace contemplation as a path for myself. But in the process of doing that, realized that I had attached my worth to my productivity. I had attached my value to what I did. And so in being still, it was such a, like I said, I can look back on it and say it was a liberating time, but in the moment it felt like a death, right? So there was like there was a grieving that was happening, even within the grief. It was a grief within the grief, right? Like I was feeling like I was lost because I was not doing, I wasn't writing, I could not, you know, post a podcast. I couldn't, you know, I had to be absolutely still and listen and understand that inherently I'm worthy, right? Inherently we have value. That if I didn't do another thing, write another book, if Black Joy never came, I would have been just as worthy. And that was hard to embrace because my trauma story, my narrative, there were parts of me that had said, in order for you to get the love and affection and acceptance that you desire, you have to do stuff. You have to dance. You have to perform. And I had been performing for well over 40 years. And to have to be forced to stop performing, stop, and hope and pray that it would be okay, that was a challenge for me. Coming out of it, what's interesting is like I was coming out of it in January 2020. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, I got the lesson, right? Because healing is finite, right? It's a destination. Once you get there, you're done. Not, right? That's not the case. And so in January, you know, I'm thinking, okay, I'm feeling really good. I was going back to teaching. I was still struggling with my health a little bit, but you know, I was gonna put the best foot forward and boom, March 2020, what do we all experience, right? The ultimate stillness. And so yeah, I spent more time in stillness and but this time with the understanding that at my core, at our core, we are loved and we are worthy. And within all of that, it actually infused my writing about social justice, about issues for Black folks, about my writing to Black folks with something else that wasn't there beforehand. Beforehand, it was about the work. We got to hit these streets. We have to make these phone calls. We have to, you know, we have to demand our rights. We have to prove that we're human, prove that we're just as worthy, prove that we're equal. And that stillness and that awareness infused a different something something, I can't even put my word on it, in my both Black Joy and Then They Came For Mine, infused something in it that came from a place of, I'm not going to prove my worthiness to you, person. I am not going to demand that you see my humanity. What I am going to demonstrate is how your humanity has been impacted by what you've done to me and my people. And maybe that approach is very different than anything I'd written before.
That's so powerful, and I really appreciate you sharing the journey of it and the, you know, the continual discovery and the way it's infused. Claudia Love and I both deal with ongoing chronic illness, and I mean, and when you're in the midst of it, you don't, you're just like, just heal me, you know. And you know, when you get to a point where you realize how much you just swim in that productivity mindset, and it's so hard to separate yourself out, but the freedom that comes when you are, and of course, and it's an ongoing journey.
Definitely ongoing.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Tracy, on page 12, you say you choose healing over reconciliation any day. Could you unpack that for us?
I don't know if reconciliation can truly happen in the way that we hope for or envision without healing being very much part of the process, right? And I think what happens so much, especially for Black folks who have experienced racial violence, either directly or indirectly, directly meaning like me and my family, or indirectly meaning the constant images that we see of unarmed Black men and women and children being harmed or killed. I think some of the problem, I think, is that there's this forced forgiveness, or, you know, we're especially in faith communities, right? We're told, you know, well, you know, that is in the past, or you have to let it go, or, you know, forgiveness is the way, you got to forgive that person who murdered your family member, you know, like all of that language just is it happens. It's as if that happens in a vacuum, right? Mm-hmm. It's as if that there isn't nothing, no other processes that have to happen, right? And so for me, forgiveness without accountability, forgiveness without justice, is harmful in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that doing the work of healing will ultimately, if everyone is doing that work, which is the reason why I kind of positioned this book to talk for Black folks and at white folks, right? Is because everybody has to be doing that work, right? And so if everybody is doing that work, then we have the opportunity for a true racial reconciliation in the most purest form. Otherwise, we're playing reconciliation. We're doing what we've done for years, tolerance, which is the reason why we have these waves of overt racial violence and then subtle and then overt and then subtle. We have these waves of it because we're never really truly getting to the heart of the matter, right? And so that, I think that's what I meant by that. I think I mean that folk, if Black folks can get the space and the time to focus on our healing from the hurt and the trauma, then the conversation around reconciliation or forgiveness or all of that doesn't even need to be in the mix, right? Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, if we're doing that work and those who call themselves allies or accomplices are doing their work, right, then we will land at reconciliation at some point down the road, wherever that point happens to be. The challenge is that we have more people not doing the work that are on both sides, right? Mm-hmm. Like we have more people who struggle with the healing, Black folks who struggle, and we can talk about mental health within our community and all those kinds of things, you know, but then we also have, of course, white folks and white people of faith who are not willing to do that work because of the discomfort. And then both sides, it's because of the discomfort, because mm-hmm. of the agitation, because of the complete and utter upheaval that both will cause. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in the cause of healing, for the cause of healing.
Yeah. I mean, we're living in a time where in America, white people are trying to get teachings about slavery,
yeah.
The civil, you know, like don't we don't want white children to be uncomfortable right. about this country's history, and right. it's crazy. It I mean, because there's so little about Black people in history books as it is,
right?
And
it's a perpetuation, though, right? Like the point of that is, we know that when you know. When a generation knows what happens, right? They know the true history. There is an opportunity for shift and change. So it only benefits people who don't want change to happen to prevent them from knowing, right? To allow them to kind of stew and settle and be raised up in this idea of superiority or supremacy. Because then, you know, and I, you know, Gen Zers, I'm around, you know, when I was teaching was around Gen Zers all the time, right? And they have a different lens and a different way of seeing the world than us Gen Xers, or, you know, I don't know what generation you guys are, but, you know, me as a Gen Xer, they see the world very differently, mm-hmm. right? And so if they're armed with the truth, then they actually might make the kinds of changes that those who want to keep these, you know, history books whitewashed do not want.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm just thinking your response just got me thinking about the whole phenomenon of spiritual bypassing in communities. And it's something I have a great interest in. But you're really helping me make some connections here to whiteness and patriarchy and all of that stuff. So I really appreciate that. And just the avoidance of that discomfort and where that comes from. And how there's this investment in not losing one's power and privilege. So thank you for that. But I do want to ask you, because you have this this powerful passage in your book, you say one of the devastating consequences of racial violence, especially when it hits close to home, is that it creates a sense that you aren't safe no matter what. That lack of safety creates a sense of despair and hopelessness that disrupts any possibility of those tingles showing up. Trauma disrupts joy. Accessing peace is disrupted by the wounding. Bodily liberation is disrupted by this thing that has told us no matter what, we are in danger. I was really moved by that. And I just want to hear more about how your experience of trauma living on in the body, and then how you, because you go on to talk about how important hope is in healing, which I agree with you. And how do we nurture that in the context of Black people having to live with this continual trauma and disruption?
I think for me, one of the challenges or one of the ways that I recognized that the trauma was living in my body was that 9 months after her murder, I couldn't bring myself to go into a grocery store. And I, to this day, lean heavily on Instacart. I do go into, the big box stores now, but that was challenging for me. And I still have a whole mental process that I go through when I do go, in terms of checking for exits and, kind of side-eyeing that man that's walking down the aisle. There's a whole thing around safety. There are processes and things that Black folks do, even almost unconsciously, in certain spaces, right? That I don't believe that white folks do in terms of protecting ourselves and safety, right? I was talking to a friend who was white, and they were talking about, what's the one thing, we were talking about like bucket list kinds of things. And, I said, one of the things on my bucket list is something I don't know I'll ever feel safe enough to do, which is I would love to just jump in a car or on a train and travel all the way across the country. Just make like 50 million stops along the way and just see parts of the country I've never seen before. And that is not something that I would be able to do without a significant amount of planning and making sure that I'm not going into a sundown town that still exists, even in my beloved state of Kentucky, right? Mm-hmm. I have to make sure that there's certain parts of the city like that, that level of hypervigilance, right? And that we have to carry is something that not only we carry in our bodies, but then we pass down, right? So there's a certain awareness. And my daughter is 11 years old, and I always say I'm trying to raise a free Black girl, and I am, as best I can, right? At the same time, it's a challenge when she starts to display her freedom in spaces where I know that she will be observed or seen not positively, negatively. And so that's hard, because I want her to be her full authentic self and be all of the things, right? I know that there's value in it, and I know that she can change the world with it. At the same time, I also know, like, I gotta get her to adulthood, right? And in the world that we live in today, it's entirely possible that should she move that way in certain spaces, that could be perceived as a threat. And so all of that, all of the hypervigilance, all of the sense of insecurity and safety that we just carry with us, that we move, that we're just taught from very early ages, definitely lives in the body, definitely governs how we move. And I think I honestly don't know how we nurture. I know that we the way that we can nurture joy and all of those other emotions and feelings and states of being, I think, is by almost disconnecting or detaching from reality. And so there is something to be said about the resilience of Black people and our ability to innovate and create in spite of, right? By definition, when I talk about Black joy, I'm talking about this idea that this universal concept of joy that every human being has, it's Black joy when it lives within a particular context and within this melanin and what this melanin represents in this world. And so there's some value in our creativity and our innovation and our cultural expressions of joy that we can then use to heal those parts that are traumatized, right? And so I talk about calling up joy, calling up, trying to make a connection between what I know about our central nervous systems, what I know about it, how our bodies function, making a connection in between that and the reality in which we lived. And so since I know that my body often doesn't know that that thing that happened 4 years ago is not actually happening right now, right? And so what I have to do in those moments when I feel the panic or the anxiety when I walk into the store is I have to actively call up a memory of joy and allow my body to feel and experience that through my imagination. Again, detached from the reality that it's very possible that somebody could come in and shoot up the place, right? Detach from that, call up that moment. So I flood my body with all those good hormones, right? All of those dopamine and serotonins and all that good stuff, so that my body understands that in this moment, this thing is not happening. In this second, this moment, this not happening right now. So then I can then proceed in a state, you know, and do what I need to do and to operate with joy and love and peace. But it's hard, right? Like to actively have to do that is the challenge, right? When you can look at the next person who doesn't look like you next to you, and there's a kind of oblivion, right? There's a kind of, at least in that regard, right? When it comes to their skin color and what that represents, there's this sense of course, let's jump in a car, let's drive 24 hours and land where we land, like that. It's a challenge that we have to do that, but I think if we're going to right size what trauma has done and what pain has done and what hurt has done, that is one route to doing that, to get in the habit of calling up what our ancestors gave us. My ancestors gave me an ancestral joy that's different than any other joy, right? That I can tap into by being still. Some For some people it's meditation, for some people it's prayers, for some people it's dancing, for some people it's movement, you know, whatever. Tap into as a stabilizing, healing force for this other stuff that also lives in the same space, the rage, the sorrow, that lives in the same space with the joy, the peace, the calm, all of those. They all kind of living in this vessel.
I
Hopefully that's
love.
not like a rambling.
No, it's beautiful because I love that sense of like the dialectic that's happening there, where there's the trauma, but then there's the practicing of the joy that can help to heal the trauma, and so it becomes this, internal healing conversation. It's really beautiful. Thank you.
So you are coming to Kentucky soon. How do you think you'll feel being in the place, in the area where your Aunt Vicky was murdered?
Funny story. Last summer was actually, I think, the first, I want to say it was the first summer that I had been home since the murder, because of the pandemic. Usually I go home once or twice a year. Because of the pandemic, I hadn't been home. Last summer, I was invited to speak at my high school. And I had a very surreal moment. My mother needed to go to the grocery and we needed to go to a Kroger. And Kroger is the store where she was murdered. Now, we didn't go to that Kroger because I don't know that I could have brought myself to go into that Kroger. But we did go to a Kroger.
That was across the street from where you're.
Well, my parents have moved since. Oh. But yes, but it is definitely across the street from where my parents lived. Okay. And, you know, across the street from where Vicky lived. So I couldn't bring myself to, she didn't need to go to that one, or she didn't go to that one. And, but walking into the store, seeing the Kroger sign, I just had a reaction, an emotional reaction to it. I thought it would be more fear. I thought I might, you know, experience a panic attack. It wasn't that. It was just a deep sorrow that came over me. And I think it was a sorrow that had an undercurrent of rage, undercurrent of anger, because I was just watching as we're going into the store. I always, because they don't sell it in any of the places I've lived since I left home, I always got to get a case of Big Red Soda. So we went to, and you know, I was like, okay, we got to get some Big Red Soda. I got to get some Grippo's chips. Like, these are all the things like from nostalgia from my childhood. And so we were in there, and I was just like trying to wrap my mind around the fact that the going to get a case of Big Red Soda could kill me. Right? Like, I was trying to wrap my mind around, and then so it's my memory started to flood with all of those, you know, Buffalo, you know, and the individual store in the Buffalo grocery store, you know, the kid that's just playing with their friends outside with a toy gun, or like these things that we thought were kind of like these ordinary, you're not in the midst, in the middle of a crime, you know, you're just walking down the street or going to the grocery or living or breathing or just living life. And that can be the thing that takes you out of here, because you happen to be walking around with this skin color, right? And I think I just had a deep sorrow with an undercurrent of rage. And I had to sit and breathe. Like, part of the lessons of my stillness time was like learning how to tap my breath and deep breathe and breathe my way through it. And so this go around, I am coming back to Louisville to actually talk about Vicky with this book, and to do a book signing and to have a conversation with the other family members who were impacted by that day. And I don't know. You know, grief is a wieldy thing, right? And you know, on the waves, the way it hits you, you know, someday you might go into it expecting that you're going to experience and you have joy that day. But then the next, you know, you kind of thinking, oh, it's not going to be too bad. And then you get hit with a wave of sorrow. And so I don't know what to expect, especially since I am actively going to be talking about this event and talking about racial violence in general. But I have a sense of readiness, mm-hmm. Or at least that no matter what, I'll be okay. Right. That, you know, even if I end up falling apart in front of the audience and busting out in tears, that even within that demonstration of my grief, that it will be okay. You know, and that's not something I've always had. Because again, I'm a performer, right? So I wouldn't want to demonstrate. I wouldn't want to show that side of me because, you know, I had to compartmentalize, you know? And so I think that I'm beyond, I don't code switch anymore. I'm not compartmentalizing anymore. I'm not tearing myself apart anymore. You will get all of me, and all of me includes my sorrow and my rage. All of me includes my joy and my peace and my love. All of me includes my intelligence and my feeble-mindedness. Like, all of those things you will get. And so I don't know what this week will bring me going back home. But I'm ready.
Well, I will bring a bottle of Big Red and a bag of Gribbles. Do you like the barbecue time?
Barbecue Gribbles. Oh.
I will be there.
I feel like I'm missing out on a very important cultural phenomenon. I don't think we had those in New York when I was growing up.
No, not in New York. I lived in New York. You guys did not have it in New York.
I love it. I wanted to touch on, because you talk also about how white people also have their own kind of inherited trauma that has had this significant impact on them, and how, you know, we project our trauma onto Black people and other people of color through the rage, through the racism, through the genocide, through all of these things. And I'm interested very much in this phenomenon of epigenetic transference of trauma. And I just wonder, have you seen any models of church communities or other kinds of communities who've been working? I know Rasma Menachem is doing a lot of this work. But how do we make some spaces that really help encourage white people as well to really own their trauma and own the projections that they're, you know what I mean? Like, to really become conscious of it. It's just, you know, I just wonder if you've seen that at work, particularly in church spaces, but maybe not.
I've seen it at work in individuals, yeah. Right? So there are individuals. I have a colleague, a former colleague of mine at the college where I used to teach. And as we were doing DEI work, she was very active, white woman, very active in assisting us. But we always used to call her John Brown, right? Because she was the put my body in the mist. If we're in a faculty meeting and, you know, I say something and it's being overlooked, she would redirect the conversation back to this person. She wouldn't center herself. She was excellent. You could tell that she was very, you know, good about being called in and, you know, like having, if I say, you know, that didn't sit right with me and here's why. She was very good about having those conversations. So I've seen it in individuals. I'm afraid that I don't know that I've seen it to the extent where I think that it's change making in organizations, and particularly within the church. And I think that's because what often has to happen for an individual to get to that point has to happen at the organizational level, which is a complete and utter unraveling.
Yeah.
And I don't know that organizations are willing to do that level of complete and utter unraveling of mindsets, belief systems, traditions, you know, constant reckoning and reconciling of behaviors, words, language that's used. Like there's a amount of work that I don't know that organizations, and I've seen organizations that do very well with, you know, creating a culture of love and care, mm-hmm. That are, you know, very mixed, you know, diverse congregations and churches and those kinds of things. I'm not going to say that those places don't exist, but I think the type of work where I'll say those churches are often not activist churches. They very much lean on love and caretaking and feeding and, you know, doing what Claudia mentioned earlier, which is like sort of the active work of loving, whether it's like, we're not going to talk about homelessness, we're going to actually provide homes, you know, or whatever, you know, they're very good at that work. But in terms of like the activists standing in front of or alongside, you know, Black organizations or Black folks, or allowing Black folks to lead them into the work, I don't see a lot of that. And I could be wrong, I just might not know. But I don't see a lot of that. And again, I think it's because there is, when we're talking about healing, mm-hmm. we're talking about epigenetics and transgenerational trauma and healing. We're talking about unearthing and revealing stuff that's in the bloodline. And so I often challenge, I remember doing a DEI workshop, and I was challenging the white people in the audience to even think about, you know, a lot of times it's either I'm not racist because I'm not overt, right? Like I'm not putting on a hood or burning a cross or calling someone the N-word, so therefore I'm not racist, but trying to look at the tiny, subtle ways that what is in the bloodline shows up. And so even saying, when you hear about it, you know, an unarmed Black man being killed, well, you know what, let's wait for more information. Mm-hmm. Or I'm not really sure if we got all the facts, or, you know, being unwilling to side with the marginalized or the person who has been victimized in that situation, that resistance is in the bloodline. So it may not, you may have had enough time, generation over generation, to reckon with or deal with overt, right, like racism, but there is an essence that can be traced along the bloodline, right, that says that I don't know quite what it is, but you're still not the same as me, right? And I don't know quite why, but I really don't want my white son to bring a Black woman home. Right. I don't know what it is. I mean, I don't have anything against Black people personally, but I just, well, there's something there, right? There's something to be unpacked and explored, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that the kind of deep dive that's going to require, especially for organizations, I have not seen yet.
Yeah. Well, and I'm just aware of how all these things, of course, are connected, and, you know, just in terms of like the spiritual bypassing we were talking about and the avoiding, you know, any kind of difficult conversations and just that sense of and what you were talking about, being able to getting in touch through your own experience of illness, of getting in touch with your worth in being and not being tied into your persona and your performance and your doing it. So, and just the threat that can cause for somebody to think about a crack in that persona or that whatever that face that we show to the world. Yeah. It's anyway, it basically, I'm seeing like it requires an earthquake. You know what I mean?
History has given us all that, right? Like history established when poor white people wanted to band with the enslaved, right? Bacon's Rebellion, right? Let's somehow, you know, the elite class, let's somehow tell poor white folks that, you know, you are at least better than the enslaved, at least better than the African, right? Even though economically you had nothing, you know, and establishing a racial hierarchy, right? So that even if all things were the same class-wise, status-wise, right, you can have that extra edge. That extra, quote, edge did something, right? Does something, right? Mm-hmm. That to make the modern present day white person, and I'm using that language just generally, I don't want to generalize, but, you know, for the sake of time, right? You know, say, I still don't know what it is, but there's something in me that does not connect to you as another human being, yeah. Right? And again, that's not everyone, but I think that a good number have those ideologies and that historical precedent somewhere in that bloodline, so that they could be the poorest of the poorest, right? And they might look at a Jay-Z and be like, well, how can I have privilege, right? Yeah. But if all things were equalized, there's this element of superiority that still mm-hmm. is ever understood by them.
I think one of the problems, well, I think probably the biggest problem is that people are not seeing this as a systemic thing, as something that has infused every aspect of our culture. Right. And, you know, they can say, hey, I grew up not, you know, to not see color. Well, if you're not seeing color, you're not seeing the system that needs to be dismantled, the system that you are benefiting from, that you are resistant to changing. That brings me to the uprising in 2020. There was some rioting going on, but there were far more Black bodies damaged than property damaged. Mm-hmm. Why do you think there was such a big deal about a Target that got, you know, damaged, right, looted, but not the young people, the Zoomers out there of all races getting rubber bullets to the face? Why was the Target more important?
Because I think it goes back to what I was just talking about. Like, there's something in the bloodline. There's something in the blood that doesn't value that Black body over that red and white Target, right? Like, it doesn't, there, and, you know, on the surface, you can say, oh, no, I value everyone. We're all equal, right? But when the rubber meets the road is when you begin to see what you actually value when there's loss. Loss is the great equalizer to tell us exactly what we believe, what where our faith lies, and what we actually value. And so to me, the answer is that because at a very core spirit level, soul level, those Black bodies don't mean as much. So that's one. Number two, it's often just a deflection, right? Because if I can talk about the rioters and, you know, the, you know, damaging of a Target that has hella insurance, right? You know, if I can talk about that, then I don't have to talk about the systems. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to talk about, if I can, and there's a whole chapter about that, and then they came from mine. If I can point it back at Black on Black crime, mm-hmm. right? Talk about, well, what about Chicago? You know, Chicago has Black and Black crime. You know, if I can deflect that, then I don't have to deal with the undercurrent of the systems that creates an environment where gangs exist, that creates an environment where poverty exists, that creates an environment where people might feel so much hopelessness and despair that they will then act out in those ways. I don't have to deal with that, right? I could just deal with the Black on Black crime, so I don't have to do what we were talking about before, that deep unraveling work of dismantling upheaval of our systems. So it's either one of two things. It's either you truly do not see the value of these human bodies, or if you do, you need a point of deflection so that you don't have to wrestle with why someone would feel so much rage, so why someone would feel a level of hopelessness and despair that they would destroy property.
Amen.
And yeah. Real talk. I'm from Kentucky. I've seen national championship celebrations do more damage than the riots did.
That part.
You know, so like, I mean, I went to the University of Kentucky during a championship year. I've seen cars on fire. Mm-hmm. Right? So like, for a win. Not because somebody lost their lives.
Right.
Because your rage or your fear, you know, and I don't think we talk a lot about, from a healing standpoint, how much the damage that the very little minuscule damage that was caused by a small minority group of people mm-hmm. is rooted also in fear, right? It's rooted in, I got to get what I can get because I'm afraid, you know, of what's going to happen on the other end. I don't really have nothing to aspire. Our educational systems are trash, right? Like, you know, all of these things are not great. So what do I have to lose? but to take this TV and go sell it and get so I can go do what I gotta do. Right or wrong, like I'm not endorsing that. I'm not saying that's the way to do it. I'm saying that we gotta have more nuanced conversations. If you really are about that life, if you're about healing and reconciliation, then the conversation has to be way more nuanced than just, oh, well, you didn't say anything about Black on Black crime.
Yeah. Thank you, Tracy, Michelle. This has been a really powerful conversation and a lot of food for thought. I would love to keep going for a long time, but I want everyone to buy this book, Then They Came for Mine, to read it, to reflect on it, and then to do that really hard work of unraveling and starting to heal. So thank you so much, Tracy, and to Claudia Love. It's been really just a beautiful privilege